Stand by. Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, DB29 for ZOS Early Migration Experiences. Today's teleconference presentation will last approximately 90 minutes and will include a live question and answer session. In this teleconference, you'll learn recent news about DB2 version 8 and new functions delivered in DB29 after general availability. Today's conference is being recorded. The speaker for today's teleconference is John Campbell, Distinguished Engineer, DB2 for ZOS Development. At this time, I would like to hand it over to our John Campbell.
Thank you very much. Welcome to this session on DB29 for ZOS Early Migration Experience. In this session, I'll be providing some additional planning guidance for you and sharing migration experiences. As I go through, I will reference the slide I'm switching to for easier reference. The objectives of this session are firstly to share lessons learned and to avoid surprises and pitfalls. I want to provide you some hints and tips. I want to address some myths that may have grown up around version 9 and reset those, and provide some additional planning information. And there's also some important new enhancements, one of which specifically is called plan stability. And I'm going to spend some time in today's session actually covering that new functional enhancement. Now what I'd like to do is to turn on to slide 3. My particular agenda here is to first of all give you some quick hits, as I call them, about preparing for the migration. And then the second stage, I'm going to go through the migration itself, give you an overview of the process, talk about a new functional enhancement called plan stability to give you a fast way of falling back the access path for static SQL. Another major topic I'll talk about here will be about converging the temporary table spaces, which is the merger of the work file and the temporary databases. In topic 3, I'm going to talk about what to expect in terms of CPU resource consumption and also in terms of DBM1 virtual storage below the 2 GB bar. And finally, there's going to be quite a long session there about more quick hits, where I'm going to talk about new functions in version 9 and some of the planning considerations and give you some proven best practice in this space. Now let's turn to slide 4. So to start with here in terms of quick hits, the first thing I'd like to talk to you about is really there's no need to fear migration to version 9 with proper planning and testing. It's a step-by-step approach adopted by many successful customers so far. Relative to version 8, it's a lot more simpler and straightforward. There's no one-way ticket. In other words, as you migrate through the various modes of version 9, you can always fall back to the previous stage. So there's no one-way ticket in which you have to fall forward. So you can fall back to the previous stage at any time. Obviously, once you've left conversion mode, as it's called now, it used to be called compatibility mode, you can only ever fall back to conversion or compatibility mode. You can't fall back to version 8. Now, in order to migrate to version 9, you have to be in version 8 new function mode, and you have to have at least on the fallback SPE, PK11129. There's an informational APAR, II12423, which gives you a list of prerequisite APARs and PTFs. Now, one thing I'd like to advertise quite strongly here for the first time is this item called plan stability. It's a brand new piece of function that was added into version 9 after general availability. It is available in conversion mode, and you can use it as part of your version 8 to version 9 migration to give you a fast fallback option for static SQL if the access path changes after rebind and you're unhappy with the runtime performance. Now, there's also a preconditioning APAR for this, PK52522, that's available on version 8. And the whole idea of this preconditioning APAR is that if you have been using plan stability on version 9 and you have multiple versions of a package, you still have the capability of falling back to version 8. And what will happen when you fall back is that the inactive packages will actually be deleted. ZOS 1.8 is a prerequisite for certain specific functions in version 9, which you may decide to exploit. First of all, the full RACF support for trusted context and roles, and also for the volume level security enhancements. A most important area to consider as part of the migration is what are the minimum prerequisite levels for DB2 Connect server. And as clearly listed on this chart here, version 9.1, but it must have FixPack 1, is one level you can use. Version 8.2, FixPack 6, and version 8.1 fixed pack 13. I'd just like to stress again, version 9.1, it must be at least on fixed pack 1. Something else I'd like to make clear very early on here is that when we introduced version 8, a lot of customers were concerned about the fact that if they use the version 8 pre-compiler, that the modified COBOL source wouldn't go through the old COBOL compilers like COBOL 2 and VS COBOL 2. What we did in version 8 was introduce via APAR a load module that looked very similar to the version 7 pre-compiler. And basically this was a technical solution to a pricing problem because we wanted you having to pay for two versions of DB2 in order to use the version 7 pre-compiler function. I'd like to point out that at this stage, there are no plans to make that version 7 pre-compiler function available under version 9. Now let's turn to slide 5. A sound maintenance strategy for maintaining DB2 software is essential for all customers, and we often talk about it, and I've talked about it quite a lot in the past. Even though I've just said that, however, there are many customers who really are not following a sound strategy. And one of our strong recommendations is to exploit the CST RSU process, where tapes are made available on a quarterly process and also on a monthly basis. And the general recommendation is to apply about 2 to 3 preventative service drops annually, and to exploit the enhanced poll data so you're vigilant on both hypers and PE. Obviously, no one-size-fits-all customers that use DB2. Clearly, those customers who are most aggressive in terms of changing their environment and exploiting new DB2 function probably need to be more aggressive in terms of their service strategy. But either way, it's very important to review the installation guide and the material supplied to ensure that the RSU-only service is installed. Although we recommend using the RSU service model, many customers have a service strategy which is what they call RSU-like. And in some cases, due to problems with IBM packaging, non-RSU maintenance has been provided along with the RSU maintenance itself. So one of the tips I've got on this chart here is to enforce installing RSU-only maintenance. And you can do that by adding the source ID RSU asterisk option in the apply and accept jobs. Note carefully, however, that if you put RSU asterisk, that will pull all their RSUs off that particular tape. Now let's turn to slide 6. In version 8, we talked about the possibility of having to use PDSE, and the reason why we did that was we were frightened that the size of the RDS module would go beyond 16 megabytes. Fortunately, it didn't, and therefore most customers decided to stick with PDSEs. However, in version 9, there is no choice. PDSE is a mandatory requirement for SDSN load and SDSN load 2. PDSE has many advantages, but it's relatively new for a lot of installations. A PDSE may only be shared by ZOS systems which are part of the same Sysplex. In other cases, a separate copy would have to be created for each separate ZOS Sysplex. It's recommended you look at the two informational APARs mentioned on this chart for related maintenance specific to PDSE. Also, there's a DB2 APAR PK59069, which is for the DB2 pre-compiler and allows the Syslib DD to refer to a PDSE. And a couple of other APAR fixes which are relevant to PDSEs. In order to migrate to version 9, not only do you have to be on version 8 new function mode, you also have to run the job DSN TIJUZ to run the job which actually expands the bootstrap data set. This is also a mandatory prerequisite. The final point on this chart is that in order to run version 9, you must have defined a 64-bit shared private area between the DBM1 and the DDF address spaces. And this must be configured by the IA Sys PalmLite member, and it must be configured at 128 gigabytes. The specific parameter in the PalmLite member is called HVShare. And this is absolutely mandatory here, and you have to do this even if you don't plan to use the DDF facility of DB2. You can use the two display commands shown on the bottom of this chart here to actually display what the allocated area is for HVShare. Now let's turn to slide 7. There's a couple of early hints and tips here based on experience with customers. And in some of these cases, these are workarounds for specific customer discoveries. The first thing to mention here is that if you have objects which are in reorg pending, like AREO, advisory reorg pending, if there are any objects that are in this status, either table spaces or indexes, you must clear those conditions before you migrate from version 8 new function mode to version 9 compatibility mode. Otherwise, you can't clear these conditions. Some customers have run into problems with packages that execute the SQL lock table statement. And we found that a way of getting around this problem is to rebind all packages which contain SQL lock table statements in version 9 compatibility mode. One thing which is called out quite strongly in the installation guide is that any plans or packages that have not been rebound since version 3 will be invalidated and auto-bound on version 9. What I strongly advise you to do even before you get to version 9 is to identify these old plans and packages and to explicitly rebind them on version 8 new function mode before you actually migrate. The reason for doing this is that if you're a data sharing customer, then any auto-bind activity across the group is serialized. And therefore, if you have a lot of plans and packages which are invalidated and have to go through auto-bind, this may cause an impact. One of the lessons we tried to learn from version 8 was that when we introduce new locking protocols, what we'd like to try and do is avoid having to quiesce the data sharing group. And so one of the things in version 9 is that we've introduced a new locking protocol called Locking Protocol 3, which is specific to large objects. When we first announced version 9, we were planning on actually having to quiesce the data sharing group in order to introduce this protocol. But now, through additional APARs put out through the service stream, we are now able to switch to Locking Protocol 3, new function mode, automatically and without having to quiesce the data sharing group. Now let's turn to slide 8. One of the things we talked about for a long time, both before and during version 9 GA, was about eliminating the DDF private protocol. However, this has actually not taken place, but we still have a strong intention to reduce DDF private protocol in the release after version 9. So we really do plan to eliminate it in the version 9 plus 1 release. In fact, I'll say that more strongly, that if you do not convert from private to DRDA protocol, you will not, in fact, be able to migrate to the version 9 plus 1 release. So it's very important that in the lifetime of version 9 in your installation, that you take the necessary actions and corrections to actually make sure that private protocol is eliminated. To help you do this, we've introduced a REX tool called DSN-TP2DP, which is called the Private to DRDA Protocol Catalog Analysis Tool, which was introduced for APAR PK27413 to help you with this conversion. We also plan to enhance it still further through the service stream going forward. But initially, what this program will do is look in the DB2 catalog, and firstly, it will create alias statements for remote locations that will probably need the two-part aliases. And it will also generate a string of commands to convert packages and plans which have a remote location dependency or can be detected to have as a result of analyzing the catalog. Let's turn to slide 9. So continuing on the theme here that DB2.9 did not eliminate private protocol, even with this tool, there still may be packages or plans remaining with DB protocol private, where there are no SQL statements within the respective plan or package that refer to remote object. Some examples of that may be, you know, there are SQL statements in the catalog which do not refer to any three-part name directly, and the aliases for the statements also do not reference. And some possible reasons for that are, one, use of dynamic SQL by the application, or secondly, the package is bound for a remote request or client. These packages that still have DB protocol equals P will have to be rebound to flip them from private protocol into DRDA protocol access. Now let's turn to slide 10. Also in the area of DDF functionality, there's an important informational APAR called II-14203, which is a summary of both DB2 and also ZOS critical maintenance related to new functions in this space, such as trusted context and SSL support in there. So it's very important to actually study that APAR and make sure that prerequisite maintenance is on. Another tip is that some of the new functions in version 9 require you to specify an IP address. And you have the option here of either specifying it in the Bootstrap dataset or specifying it on the port statement of the TCP/IP profile via the bind keyword. Note very carefully, the two things are actually mutually exclusive. So basically, it only should be specified in one place. Now, specific to the SSL support, DDF only supports secure ports when it is listening in on the in address ANI. If secure port is defined in the Bootstrap and no IP address can be specified in the port statement of the TCP/IP profile. Now let's turn to slide 11. Now I'm going to move on and talk about some remove functions and incompatibilities. First and foremost, all stored procedures now must be modified to become WLM enabled. DB2 managed stored procedures are now eliminated. The legacy JDBC driver will not work with version 9, so you have to use the Universal Java client for DB2. In DB2 9, existing WLM environments must be configured to use this new driver. And basically, if you don't change the JCLs and they continue to reference the legacy DB2 for ZOS driver, they will encounter a failure when the address space is initialized. This will happen as soon as compatibility mode, as well as in the other modes of version 9. Anybody who's running data sharing with version 8 and version 9 in coexistence will experience a failure if the Java routine is invoked on any DB2 members running version 9. So a strong recommendation here is to modify your WLM SPAS JCL to switch to using the Universal JDBC driver while still on V8, and to do that ahead of your migration to version 9. Now let's turn to slide 12, other remove functions and incompatibilities. The ability to create simple linear table spaces has been removed in version 9, and there are new defaults. So for example, if you try to explicitly create a simple table space, we will still honor the create, but we will create it as a classic segmented table space. In cases where it's implicitly created table space, we will either generate it as a segmented table space during compatibility mode, or generate it as a universal table space and a position by growth variety if you're in new function mode. So general recommendation here is to plan ahead and to aim at converting existing simple table spaces to either classic segmented or UTS or partitioned ahead of your V9 migration. As part of our overall plan to eliminate private protocol for DDF, the DB2 protocol, ZPalm, has been removed in version 9, and the default distributed protocol for BIME will now be DRDA. A long-standing ZPalm is called Release Cursor Hold, and this ZPalm has been completely removed in version 9. This particular ZPalm, whether you set it to yes or no, was really only used by a small number of customers, and it was related to open with hold cursors. I mean, the default behavior was that if you had an open with hold cursor across a commit, that when the commit happened, we would release the page and the row locks so that these would not be held across the commit, but we'd hold the claim count as +1 to prevent a drain. So the option of saying release cursor hold equals no was a previous option in the ZPalm, so you could actually say, please hold onto those page or row locks across the commit. So that function was hardly ever used by any customers or even vendors, and we've removed it in version 9. Now let's turn to slide 13. Other deprecated functions going forward is, first of all, plans containing DVRMs. It is our intention in the release after version 9 to eliminate DVRMs bound directly into plans. Now, to help you do that, we will plan to come out with some tooling via APIs to help you identify plans which have DVRMs bound directly into that. And also, as part of the migration process from version 9 to version 10, if we discover any remaining plans which have DVRMs bound directly into the plan, we will automatically convert to packages. So what I strongly recommend you to do as part of your plan for V9, overall plan, and within the cycle time of V9, to consider converting all the DVRMs bound directly into plans and converting them into packages. As part of version 9, we have eliminated the acquire allocate option on plans. And as already stated a couple of slides earlier, simple table space creation has now been removed in version 9 as well. There are some important changes to defaults. Managed extent size allocation was introduced in version 8. And this is where DB2 would automatically adjust the size of the secondary allocation in order to make sure that data set could scale to its maximum theoretical size. Now, there are several rules related to sliding secondary quantity or secondary extent allocation, but one of those rules was controlled by ZPalm called managed extent size. The default was no in version 8, and in version 9, the default has changed to yes. Now, this ZPalm was only applicable to what I call Rule 4. the fourth rule in the set. This is where the user object, whether it be an index or a table space, has an explicit primary and secondary quality allocated to the object. And basically what manage extent size equals yes achieves is that enables DB2 to override the explicit secondary quantity provided by the user in order to make sure that the table space can scale up in size. A most important change related to bind options is a change to the default value for isolation and a default value for current data. In previous releases, the default for isolation was repeatable read, and the default for current data was actually yes. And from customer experience over many health check studies, we found that usually by accident, a lot of the options for isolation and current data were defaulting to bad values. So as part of version 9, we've changed the defaults. So the default for isolation is cursor stability. The default for current data is now going to be no. And this is in line with recommended best practice for scalable performance and high concurrency. Now let's turn to slide 14. Slide 14 gives you an overview of the overall migration process. And the chart is going left to right in terms of time. What you can see from the chart here is that, first of all, would be to run the cat main job to make some of the catalog changes. And before doing that, you must make sure you're in new function mode on version 8, that the bootstrap has been reformatted, and you've got the fallback SBE installed. After having been in cat main, our recommended best practice is to stay in version 9 conversion mode. This used to be called compatibility mode, to stay in there for 1 to 2 months. And the whole idea of staying there for 1 to 2 months is to stay there for basically a typical application processing cycle and to make sure that version 9 compatibility mode is running stable and without having any high impact problems. As before, we are recommending that if you're a data sharing customer and you've decided to run in release coexistence, in other words, you're going to mix version 8 and version 9 for a period of time, to limit that period of coexistence. And most customers who are following best practice are keeping that period of coexistence 1 week or less. However, some other customers may decide to run for longer than that. There's no absolute limit on how long you can either run in conversion mode or how long you can actually run in coexistence mode. So there's no issues here about time limits or service and support. We will give first-class support for both conversion mode and coexistence. However, what we would say is that experience tells us that if you run in data sharing coexistence for a long period of time, you're more likely to run into a problem that's unique to coexistence as opposed to being in the new release. So once you're convinced that you're running stable in conversion mode, you can then submit the ENFM job followed by the new function mode job. Now what's different here relative to version 8? If ever there is a problem in ENFM, you can always fall back to compatibility mode, or now known as conversion mode. And similarly, if you're in new function mode, you can always fall back to ENFM. Now let's turn to slide 15. Slide 15 tries to summarize the migration and fallback paths. And the key message that's shown by the diagram here is you can always fall back to the previous stage. Note that there actually are additional modes in version 9. And these are your compatibility mode star or conversion mode star and ENFM star. And basically what the star indicates is that you were previously on the later mode. So, for example, if you're on new function mode and you fall back to ENFM, then if you were to do a display group command, you'd find the mode of DB2 version 9 is ENFM star. Now let's turn to slide 16. This is the topic that I want to spend a lot of time on because I think it's very valuable to all of you to help you migrate your static SQL applications to version 9. This is a brand new function of version 9 introduced by APAR PK52523. It tries to protect customers against access path regression for static SQL. Quite simply, it tries to provide a very safe way to fall back to the previous version without having to do a rebind. It's available as soon as version 9 compatibility mode, otherwise known as conversion mode, and it can benefit the migration and fallback. I am strongly recommending this to all customers who use static SQL. There's a preconditioning APAR for plan stability, PK52522, and the recommendation is to apply that to all your version 8 new function mode systems. So here's me advertising this function for you. Well, then the question is, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that sometimes when you rebind your packages, you may get an access path change. It may or may not look good, but ultimately what you care about is the runtime performance. Now, most of the time, access path changes are very beneficial, and they improve the query runtime performance. But sometimes it doesn't. It may be due to a defect in DB2. It may be due to missing statistics. It may be due to stale statistics, or it may be due to host variables and placement markers, and therefore the optimizer doesn't know enough about what the values are, particularly on range predicates, and doesn't make a good access path choice. But anyway, if we have static SQL that goes through rebind with a change of access path, and you haven't got good runtime performance, what are your options? Especially, what are your options if you have a lot of these changes and you need to react very quickly? Well, there's no really easy way to undo the rebind. And as a consequence of that, that caused a lot of grief to you, our customers, and also to IBM service. Now let's turn to slide 17. So what are the existing solutions? Well, we can prevent rebinds altogether. Some customers have different strategies. Some customers always rebind on a regular basis after a reorg and a run stats. Some people maybe rebind once in the life of a given release. And some people try to avoid rebinds altogether. And obviously that's a bit of an extreme case. Now, another approach was to rebind into alternate collections. Now, there are two flavors of this approach. We sometimes refer to this alternate collection as a dummy collection. One approach, basically, is to rebind all the packages into a dummy collection, otherwise known as a test collection, and then to compare the access path information from version 9 versus version 8. And for those packages where there are no changes in access path, then the customer can go ahead and safely rebind all their packages. Where there are differences, then the customer may take extra care and extra testing to figure things out. Or the other approach is to use optimizer hints. But hints are actually cumbersome to use, and also they're exactly that. They are a hint. So there are going to be some cases where the actual hint may not be strong enough in terms of, you know, index use. The hint says, please use this index, but DB2 will determine how it uses this index. And if we have SQL that goes through query transformation, the query transformation takes place after the hint is applied. So whenever you look at any of these three solutions here, none of them are perfect, and many customers would describe them as being inadequate. So we've been trying to pursue a solution in DB2 which will actually help you in this situation, and we've introduced it initially in version 9 in compatibility mode to help you. It is limited functionality in this first release, but I think it's very valuable functionality for you to use. It applies only to static SQL. And the solution is basically quite simple. At rebind time, DB2 will save away the old copies of the packages. It's a bit like implicit versioning. And we give you the ability to store away either two or three versions of the package, and through a rebind switch command, you can switch back to the previous version or switch back to the original version, like, for example, the original version being the version that you took with you from version 8 new function mode into version 9 compatibility mode. And basically, in the event of a performance runtime regression, users have a very simple way to fall back to the older copy. Now let's turn to slide 18. Slide 18 is a pretty busy chart here, and it's really talking a lot about syntax, but I will walk around the chart and explain things to you. First of all, in the top left-hand corner here, at rebind time, what DB2 is going to do if you use plan stability is it's going to save away old copies of packages in both the catalog table and in the directory SPT01. We will store away either two or three versions. Or if you want to, you can actually disable the function, in which case we'll just keep one version. Note carefully, however, whether you use two versions or three versions, if the access path, the runtime, is exactly the same in all versions, we still store additional copies of the packages. So one thing to be aware of in this first release in version 9 is that there will be an increased space requirement in SPT01. And for some customer systems, you may not be able to use this as a global default. You may have to use it selectively on performance-sensitive packages. Now, there are two flavors of plan stability. It's called basic or extended. And in fact, in the ZEPALM, there are three values for the plan management ZEPALM: basic, extended, and off. This is a global default. And the advantage of setting basic or extended in the ZPOM plan management is this avoids having to change your jobs for doing rebinds. So by default, plan management is actually off. You can set the global default in the ZPOM, but even if you switch it off in the ZPOM, you can overrule this on the rebind package command. So the plan management keyword is also available as part of the rebind package syntax, and you can either specify basic or extended. Now, when we say basic, we keep the current and the previous version, and if we say extended, we will keep three versions, the current, the previous, and the original. I will take you through on some follow-on charts here where I will actually take you through what this means, and you'll get a better idea about what we mean by previous and original. We've extended the syntax for the rebind package command with a new keyword called switch. And if you say switch previous, it will switch or flip between the current and the previous copies. And if you say switch original, we will switch between the current and the original. There's a new keyword called plan management scope that's been added to the free package command. You can say plan management scope is all, in which case we will free off all versions of the subject package. Or you can specify plan management scope inactive, in which case we'll only free off the old copies. And by the old copies, I mean the original and the previous. And this is quite an important option here because eventually, hopefully, you'll be migrating to version 10. And so once you're running smoothly on version 9, there's going to come a point when you want to throw away the original and populate it with a good version 9 function. So the way of resetting the original is to execute the free package command with the keyword plan management scope inactive, and that will delete the original. And then the next time you go through a rebind operation, the original version will then be populated again. So in terms of the catalog support, syspackage reflects the active copy. Syspack dependency reflects the dependencies of all copies. In terms of invalidation and autobind, each copy is treated separately. And when an autobind activity occurs, it only replaces the current copy. The previous and the original are not affected. Now let's turn to slide 19. So on this slide, slide 19, and the following slide, slide 20, I've got some examples here to illustrate how plan stability works. Now here on slide 19, I've got an example where you're using what's called plan management basic support. When you have plan management basic support, there are two versions. So let me explain this now, and assume here you're migrating from version 8 to version 9 conversion mode. So currently in the catalog, we only have one copy. Let's call that the current copy. So what happens when you do your first rebind using Plan Management Basic on version 9 conversion mode? The current copy is saved away now as being the previous copy, and the version 9 version then becomes the current active copy. The second time you do a rebind on version 9 conversion mode with Plan Management Basic, the previous copy is thrown away, deleted. The first copy under version 9, which is now the current copy, becomes the previous, and the second version of the package bound under version 9 becomes the current. On the right-hand side of the chart here is an example about what happens when you say rebind with switch previous. When you say switch previous, there's a flip-flop here between the current copy becomes the previous and the previous copy becomes the current. So this switch command does not execute a proper bind operation. It just simply swaps around. So what was the previous copy now becomes the current copy and the active copy. It gives you a fallback option. Now let's turn to slide 20. Now, example on slide 20 is based on plan management extended. This is where we have three copies of the package, the current, the original, and the previous. Again, to illustrate the example, let's think of version 8 to version 9 migration. So on migrating, first of all, into version 9 conversion mode, we don't have an original copy, and we don't have a previous copy. We just have the current copy, which is the copy that was brought forward from version 8 new function mode. So the first time there's a rebind on version 9 conversion mode, the current copy is saved away as both the original and the previous copy. So the original and the previous copy are the version that was carried forward from version 8 new function mode. The copy of the package after the first bind on version 9 conversion mode now becomes the current copy. Now the second time you do a rebind operation on version 9, the original copy remains untouched. The previous copy is deleted. The current copy becomes the previous copy. So the previous copy is the first version under version 9. And the current copy becomes the second version under version 9. Now, at some point in the future, you may want to get rid of the original copy. You may want to do this in planning for your migration from version 9 to version 10. And the way to get rid of the original copy and also the previous copy is to save free package with the keyword management scope and you specify inactive. And once you do that, the next time there's a rebind operation after that free package command, then the original copy is populated again. What you see on the right-hand side is an example of the rebind switch command. You can say rebind switch original or rebind switch previous. This example for illustration here simply says rebind switch original. And what happens when you do this is that the current copy becomes the previous copy and the original copy becomes the current copy. Now let's turn to slide 21. So I want you and recommend to you that you all incorporate the use of plan stability into version 9, into your migration plan. Some of you, of course, may be concerned about running out of space in the SPT01 directory table. The maximum size of this is 64 gigabytes. In the release after version 9, we plan to actually remove that space limit. Some of you may not be able to use plan stability, extended plan management, as a global default for your version 9 migration. So in those cases, what you ought to consider doing is just using plan stability on those packages which are performance sensitive or based on experience. Now, one way of identifying that is to do what I said earlier on, is to introduce the concept of a test or a dummy package. In other words, rebind all your packages into a dummy collection and compare the plan table information from version 8 to version 9. And if there's no difference, then basically just go ahead and rebind because the new version is exactly the same as the old. And for those which are different, to use the plan management keyword on the rebind command for those packages which change access path in version 9. So one thing I recommend that you do as well is don't rush in straight away and rebind, do a mass rebind on version 9 conversion mode. Delay the rebind until you're running stable on version 9 compatibility mode. In the follow-on slide, I will talk about what are the drivers to the need to actually do the rebind at all. But the recommendation is to delay the rebind on conversion mode until you're running stable. I'm also recommending that you don't do a rebind in conversion mode until the run stats has been run. Now, the reason for that is in version 9, there are optimizer changes to algorithms and the cost models, but we also made some changes in the statistics that we collect. And basically, there's a new ZPOM called Stat Plus, which has the values basic or enhanced. Enhanced is the default. And I strongly recommend that in version 9 that you run with the default value for the Stat Plus ZPOM. And what the enhanced statistics collection is in version 9 is there are some major changes to the cluster ratio calculation, which provide better statistics to the optimizers in cases, for example, when the data rows may be all random with respect to the clustering index, or where we have basically heavily non-unique index keys, and also we might maybe have a descending index. And we also have another statistic called the data repetition factor. So I feel it's very important here that, first of all, you should collect the run stats, these new statistics or modified statistics in version 9, do that in conversion mode, and then after doing that, do the rebinds. So if you're not using the IBM run stats utility, I suggest you check in with your respective software vendor and make sure that their version of the run stats utility collects the modified version of the cluster ratio calculation and also populates a new statistic called data repetition factor. Now let's turn to slide 22. Well, why rebind? Well, earlier on in the life of version 9, DB2 development told you, there was no need to rebind for performance in version 9. However, that's not in fact true. Just like in version 8, if you have plans or packages that use sprocs, then these sprocs will be invalidated when they're touched in version 9. In reality, sprocs are used by most plans or packages. Most plans and packages contain select statements. So this affects most plans and packages. And sprocs are actually used for fast column processing. And these are actually built as part of the bind process. So any plans and packages with sprocs that were bound, even on version 8, will be disabled when they're touched in version 9. So as a result of them being invalidated or disabled, these sprocs will have to be built dynamically at execution time. Now this will introduce some overhead, some increase in CPU resource consumption, and that typical performance impact is in the range of 0 to 10%. Most people won't see anything like 10%, but it is possible to see a figure like 10%, particularly if you have a large amount of selects, and those selects select an awful lot of columns. Now, is this a problem or not? Well, if you haven't decided to rebind, then one way of knowing whether or not this is a problem or to know the scale of the problem is to look in the DB2 statistics trace. If you were to look at a column called bypass call, which is part of the miscellaneous section of the DB2PM statistics trace, this will give you an indication as to how many times sprocs have been disabled. And also IFCID 224, which is a performance trace, can be used to identify plans and packages which need to rebind to re-enable the sprocs. So bottom line is that if you've got plans and packages that have sprocs, which is most of them in fact, rebinding plans and packages under version 9 will re-enable them and reduce CPU regression. And the second reason for rebinding the plans and packages under version 9 is to take advantage of the additional virtual storage constraint relief that was provided for static SQL. Now let's turn to slide 23. What I'm trying to do here is deliver you a sample strategy for migrating. So in an ideal world, what I'd like you to do is to exploit the extended version of plan stability. And like I said in my earlier chart here, when you do the initial rebind, the current version will be the version 9 version. The previous and the original version will be the version 8 version. And if you ever need to switch back, you can say rebind package switch previous. And when you do subsequent rebinds, then the current version becomes the latest version 9 version. The previous version becomes the previous version 9 version. And the original version is the original version 8 version that you took forward out of version 8 new function mode. And you can use rebind package switch previous to fall back to the previous version. Now let's turn to slide 24. In the unfortunate event that you actually have to fall back to version 8 from version 9 conversion mode, there's two options here. One is you can use rebind package switch original and run that on version 9 conversion mode before falling back, so that will reinstate the version 8 version of the package as the default. Alternatively, you can just fall back. Now, if you fall back, then of course, basically, the package will have to go through auto bind. And it's also essential that you have the fallback toleration PTF on for plan stability that I mentioned earlier. Now, in the future, to remind you of something I said earlier, if in the future you want to establish a new original version, for example, to move forward to the new version after version 9, then use the free package command with the keyword plan maintenance scope equals inactive to free off the original, which will also free off the previous version. Now let's turn to slide 25. And let's go on to the second part of the presentation. We'll now turn to slide 29. So we just actually skipped over two or three slides here, which are actually header slides. So on slide 29, it's titled Temporary Space, the DB2 version 8 picture. So if we look at version 8 story first of all, we have two temporary databases. We have the work file database, which is shown on the left-hand side of this chart, which in non-data sharing is in a database called DSN4K01. And in data sharing, you can create it as a work file and specify what the name is. And the work file database is used for the sort work files and also for created global temporary tables. On the right-hand side of this chart, we also have this thing called the temporary database, which is separate from the work file database. And this database is used for the declared temporary tables and also for scrollable cursors and also for regular declared globally temporary tables. Now, if we now turn to slide 30, What we're trying to do in version 9 is actually merge the work file and the temporary database. So in other words, one set, one database with work files to satisfy all the requirements. So this will cover the sought work files, the created globally temporary tables, the created temporary tables, and also declared globally temporary tables for scrollable cursors. So this will be available as soon as version 9 conversion mode. And as part of the installation migration support, there's a REX program provided as part of DSN-TI-JTM, which will do this for you. Now, one thing to bear in mind here, and I'll say it straight away now and remind you later, is that this is available as soon as conversion mode. And what you must make sure is that you don't delete the old temporary database. Because if you're in the fortunate event that you ever have to fall back to version 8 new function mode, you will fall back to using the temporary database. So you shouldn't delete the temporary database until you're sure you're running comfortably on version 9. So these work file databases, or should I say, this work file database and the associated physical files must be sized to contain the total demand from all these four different types of work. Now, as part of this change, these work files will be converted to DB2 managed instead of user managed in the sysdefault storage group. They will also be converted to use segmented table space organization. Now, a thing to bear in mind here is that the merged work file database, the physical files, will only have 4K and 32K page sizes. There'll be no support for 8 and 16. Now turn to slide 31. So, some pointers here about migration from version 8. In order to actually reclaim the space used by the temporary database work files under version 8, then you have to drop the temporary database, but don't drop it too quickly. Wait until you're running smoothly on version 9 before you do this. One thing I'd also say as well is, remind you again, you have to size the physical work files in the temporary database to support the aggregate workload requirements. One thing that you've covered in a number of our performance presentations is that in version 9, there's much more use of the 32K work file for various types of particularly large sort activity. So when actually specifying the size of the work file for the temporary database, make sure you actually size up the amount of space allocated to the 32K work file. So there'll be much more use of 32K work files and a reduced usage of 4K work files in version 9. Now there's a ZPOM that was introduced in version 8 called DSVCI. And basically, this is because DB2 in version 8 introduced support for large CI size. So for DB2 page sizes of 8K, 16, and 32K, DB2 by default, once you went to new function mode and dataset went through reallocation, would match the CI size to match the page size. And this could deliver performance improvement for sequential processing. However, a number of you had to actually set the ZPOM to basically know because of ISV vendor utilities and tools. So you may want to revisit this decision. So if you've got this ZPOM set to no in your version 8 system today, you may want to revisit that decision and check in your respective vendor and check whether they now support the larger CI size. Now turn to slide 32. Now, in addition to actually consolidating the work file space, we're also trying to provide better controls and better instrumentation around the use of the work file database. So the new ZPOM called MaxTemps, and this can be configured as part on the install panel, and basically this is a limit on the maximum amount of work file space exceeded for any given thread, any given agent. And if that limit is exceeded, the application will get a -904 SQL code with recent code Charlie90305. And the message is shown actually on this chart here, and I think it's fairly explicit. We now turn to slide 33. We're also trying to provide enhanced instrumentation. So if we go to the top right-hand slide of this slide here, in ISSID 3, which is part of the straits, we've updated it with new counters, which will first of all indicate, basically, the amount of space being used, including the number of times that max temps was actually exceeded. And it will also give you additional information in there as well about exception data. In other words, tell you information about how many times a 32K work file had to be used because there was a shortage of 4K work file space and vice versa. And in the bottom left-hand corner, IFKID2 also gives you the current and the high watermark storage amount also for the work files. If KID 343 provides information at the user, plan, and system level, and this is a way when you've got Performance Trace Class 3 on, or explicitly ask for this if KID 343 by Performance Trace Class 30, it will be written every time the max temps limit is exceeded for a given agent. Now let's go to slide 34. Probably the most typical question I will get asked on migration to every release, and especially following the performance regression on version 8, is what will it do to my CPU performance when I migrate to version 9, and what are the differences across the various modes? Well, first of all, let me say that the target for DB2 development was that when a customer migrated from version 8 new function mode to version 9, any mode, the objective was to get roughly equivalent performance or even better relative to version 8 new function mode. So this is a very positive story compared to version 8. And there's obviously potential for having maybe up to 10% performance improvement on version 9 because of the performance improvements that you can either take advantage of automatically or as a result of rebind or by exploiting new function. But I always prefer to be on the conservative side, and I think I would advise you strongly not to start spending any benefits until you see them for yourself. What you should do is assume that provided you're running on reasonably current hardware and there are no bad access path changes, that CPU performance should be roughly equivalent from version 8 new function mode into version 9 compatibility mode and beyond. So when I meant by latest hardware, I'm talking about a Z890, a Z990, a Z9 or a Z10. And obviously I mentioned earlier that any plans or packets that use SProcs will be disabled and a rebind operation is required as well. The only area where I honestly expect to see significant CPU regression is if you try to run DB2 version 9 on old hardware like the Z800 and the Z900, where I expect to see CPU regression maybe as high as 10%. Now, why is this? Well, the thing is, in version 9, DB2 is making much more use of what's called the long displacement facility instructions. And this is supported by hardware on the latest technology, but on Z800 and Z900, these are being emulated. And that's why we see the CPU regression on version 9 running on this old hardware. Now, one area which may see some healthy reductions in CPU resource consumption, in other words, improved performance, is for data sharing customers. In version 9 new function mode, data sharing customers may see significant CPU savings from, first of all, reduced latch class 19 contention and also less spinning to get a unique LRSN number. So let me give you a little bit more detail about this. In a data sharing environment, each DB2 log record has a log record sequence number as opposed to a log RBA. And each log record in a particular member must have a unique LRSN. And the LRSN is 6 bytes, and it's the high-order 6 bytes of the store clock. And in terms of granularity, it's unique to the nearest 16 microseconds. Now, as processor technology has got faster, Z9, Z10, etc., there's a greater chance that as hardware processor speeds get faster, that there'll be more collisions in terms of getting duplicate LRSNs. And when we get a collision on a duplicate LRSN, what that DB2 member must do is spin up to 16 microseconds in our code to generate a unique LRSN. Now, in version 8, the rule was that each log record on a member must have unique LRSN. And if it wasn't, we had to spin. And when we actually spin to get a unique LRSN, DB2 would hold what's called the log output latch, or latch class 19. So in version 9, we provide some welcome relief here, and it's introducing version 9 new function mode. Basically, each log record no longer has to have a unique LRSN. It is only consecutive records or successive log records to the same index or data page that must have a unique LRSN. In the following example, let's assume that log records 1 and 5 are for the same page. So log records 1 through 4 can have the same LRSN, there is no problem. But log records 1 and 5, because this is the same page, must have unique LRSN. So if the time gap between log record 1 and log record 5 is not more than 16 microseconds, DB2 will still have to spin. But anyway, this is most welcome CPU resource consumption relief, and also DB2 will no longer hold latch class 19, when it's actually doing the spin. Now let's turn to slide 35. Another thing to be aware of straight away is that when you get to version 9 conversion mode, dynamic prefetch will actually replace all sequential prefetch, except in the case of table space or partition scans. So this will happen automatically. There's no need to actually do a rebind. And the reason we've actually made the switch is that dynamic prefetch has got a much more robust algorithm than sequential prefetch and is better able to deal with situations where data is slightly disorganized. So in version A, when pages were read in via dynamic prefetch, they were marked as sequential, and when they were subsequently referenced by a random get page, they were actually reclassified as random. In version 9, these pages are not reclassified following a subsequent touch with a random get page. For those of you who relied on sequential prefetch being recorded in the actual plan table, so when you do an explain, there's a prefetch column in the plan table, and if sequential prefetch was being used, it would be marked with S, and you would use that as a way of comparing across one plan table versus another, like version 8 versus version 9. Please note that although we've switched to dynamic prefetch at runtime, DB2 will still mark prefetch as S in the plan table. Now let's turn to slide 36. Many of you are keenly interested in any additional virtual storage constraint relief that we in DB2 can provide, and we have made some incremental changes in version 9 to give you some additional virtual storage constraint, but please bear in mind, mileage will vary quite widely by customer. Chart 36 shows on the left-hand side the version 8 picture, and on the right-hand side, version 9. So let's talk about the left-hand side under version 8. In version 8, what we did in DB2 was we split the EDM pool into three separate EDM pools. There was two EDM pools above the bar, one for the global dynamic statement cache, and one for the database descriptors. And in the EDM pool remaining below the bar, we have the skeleton cursor tables, the skeleton package tables, the cursor tables, and the package tables. If you now compare that with version 9, what we've decided to do is split the EDM pool up further. So we're now going to have five EDM pools. The database descriptor pool and the global dynamic statement cache still remain above the bar. But basically, 100% of the skeleton cursor table pages and the skeleton package table pages will be moved above the bar, and a portion of the cursor tables and the package tables. So approximately 70% of the CTs and PTs will remain below the bar. And the next area to compare and contrast between version 8 and version 9 is the local dynamic statement cache. The local dynamic statement cache is used by some customers to avoid the cost of a short prepare. They will use the bind option keep dynamic yes, so that the actual executable is copied from the thread into the local dynamic statement cache. So only a subset of users who's in dynamic SQL will actually benefit from this using keep dynamic yes, because it means changes to the actual application. So customers, for example, who run SAP or, for example, have optimized their WebSphere DB2 execution may be making extensive use of keep dynamic yes. Well, anyway, in version 8, the local dynamic statement cache, 100% of it, was below the bar. Now, in version 9, we've actually split the local dynamic statement cache into two pieces, and a portion of that is above the bar. Roughly about 50% of the local dynamic statement cache is moved above the bar. Now let's move to slide 37. Now the obvious question is, what's in it for me? What's the impact? Well, if I try and net this down into something that's simple and consumable, let's split this into two simple cases. The static SQL user on the top and the dynamic SQL user on the bottom. So in order to get the virtual storage constraint relief for static SQL, a rebind is required. And after the rebind, the skeleton CT and the skeleton PT is moved above the bar. A portion of close to 30% of the CT and the PT has moved the bar. And what we've observed is an average estimated reduction of 60%, but there are quite wide fluctuations. There's not one size fits all. But one thing I want to caution you about strongly is that with version 9, the remaining EDM components below the bar in the EDM pool are only the CTs and the PTs. There's nothing that's stealable there. So I want to caution you strongly about trying to spend all the benefits up front, and to make sure you do not underconfigure the remaining EDM pool below the bar. So my rough estimate, if you think of it as a wiggle factor or headroom, is to plan on 2x70% of the number of CT and PT pages as you measure it in a version 8 statistics trace. Now, for the dynamic SQL users, the only way you're going to get a benefit is if you're using the bind option keep dynamic yes. If you're not using keep dynamic yes, there will be no benefit or little or no benefit for dynamic SQL users. And even if you do use the dynamic SQL option here of keep dynamic yes, the rough estimate is that you'll roughly save 50% of the version 8 size of the local dynamic statement cache. Now, obviously, if the size of the local dynamic statement cache is significant, then 50% of a large number would be significant. But on the other hand, if you're a customer who used keep dynamic yes but was constrained on virtual storage and therefore had to have a very low value for max keep D and have to use the additional ZPOM to free off the section as opposed to at commit, then 50% may be 50% saving of a very small area. Now let's turn to slide 38. So the expectation here on thread storage, and by thread storage I mean the user thread storage, the system agents, and the stack storage, roughly we're expecting to be plus or minus 10% in this area overall. Now, we introduced a new command or a new option on the display thread command in version 8, and I'd like to advertise this as part of version 9. It was introduced in version 8 by the APAR PK20800. The new keyword is called service storage. And with that keyword option on display thread, it will actually display out for you the agent local storage. It won't display stack, it'll just display agent local storage. And there are three counters. There's what's called the long pool and the very long pool, which are the areas of agent local allocated below the bar, and these two numbers need to be added together. And the third counter is the agent local pool above the bar, in other words, 64-bit storage. So I was going to try and summarize up the potential for virtual storage constraint relief on version 9. I'm really talking about somewhere like 0 to 300 megabytes, but I don't think many installations will get 2 or 300 megabytes. There are several reasons for that. One is if you're an IMS Transaction Manager customer and you have a very large ECSA, then your private area is already very small, and I can't see anybody getting 200 or 300 megabytes of relief when your private area is only 1 gigabyte to start with. Secondly, even if you are using Keep Dynamic Yes, many customers already have used Max Keep D and the other ZPOM that's available to constrain the amount of space being used by the local dynamic statement cache. So if you are virtual storage constrained and you have limited the amount of the size of the local dynamic statement cache, then again, the amount of virtual storage constraint relief may be quite modest. Now let's turn to slide 39. So now I want to move into the last section of this presentation and give you some more quick hits in a number of topics around the function in version 9. Now, something that's caused confusion for some people is that some of the utility function is available as soon as version 9 conversion mode. So one of the things I want to do here on this first point is actually clarify a few things. First of all, object-level recover from system-level backups is available as soon as version 9 conversion mode. Normally, people would say this should only be available in new function mode, but in actual fact, this object-level recover from system-level backups is available as soon as conversion mode. However, another piece of new function in version 9 is called recover to an arbitrary point in time with consistency. This piece of function is only available in new function mode. Now, there is a package of very nice improvements to the version 9 copy utility. First of all, the copy utility will now use an MRU algorithm for its pages. In other words, the DB2 buffer manager will be using a most recently used algorithm. And this is quite useful because historically, one of the complaints about the DB2 copy utility is that when you ran your copy suite, you're running against lots of objects in a particular time window, then the copy utility, because it's reading lots of pages through the buffer pool, would actually pull in lots of new pages into the buffer pool, and those sequential pages would actually flush out or eject out useful random pages out of the buffer pool. So the MRU algorithm will stop this situation, and so the copy utilities, when it runs, will not eject useful random pages out of the buffer pool, and it will also generate some healthy CPU savings. Also, I'm a big fan that when you have data corruption, that you want to detect it as soon as possible. And back in version 6, we introduced an option called check page, which would actually, when the copy utility was running, would actually check inside the page and make sure there was integrity. Now, there was two problems with this. First of all, this would introduce about 5 to 10% extra CPU on a per page basis. And also, when it found something, it would set the copy pen condition. And of course, when the copy pen condition is set, it will actually block any SQL updates. So the good news here in version 9 is that the check page option, first of all, is on by default. And the second thing is that it will not set the copy-pend condition. And last of all, when you look at the package of improvements here across the copy utility in version 9, this will all be done with less CPU. The next point on this chart is a bit of caution here, a little bit of caution, about using a very large index page size. There's been a lot of enthusiasm from many customers about index compression in version 9. And in version 9, in order to use index compression, you must be using a large page size. Previously in version 8, the only option for a page size index was always 4K. But in version 9, you have the option of using 8K, 16, and 32K page size for index compression. And what happens with index compression is that when DB2 comes to write the page out, DB2 will try to take the large page size, 8, 16, or 32 pages, and try and scrunch this, squeeze this down, compress it down, so it'll be written out as a 4K CI. Now, there's a danger with going to a very large page size. If you go to a large page size of, say, 16 or 32K, and most of the references to the index pages are random, then this could adversely affect the buffer pool hit ratio for the index buffer pool. And so if you are going to go for a very large page size, you need to look seriously about increasing the size of your index buffer pool. So the other disadvantage of having a large page size is that DB2 must make sure that when you have a large page size, that as index entries and RIDs are added into the index entries, DB2 must make sure that the large page size can get compressed down to a 4K CI. And if DB2 detects that, basically, if it adds more data into the large page size and it cannot be compressed down, then DB2 will stop adding extra index entries and RIDs to that page. So there's a danger if you have a very large page size and the RIDs and the key does not compress well, there's a danger of using a lot of wasted space. So generally, whether it be aggravation of the buffer pool hit ratio or wasted space inside the page, I think it's wise to be conservative when using index compression and start with an 8K page size and monitor the effect on the buffer pool, check to see that you get a good compression ratio, and balance off the benefit, the costs, and the trade-offs with using index compression. Now let's turn to slide 40. Another nice enhancement in version 9 in new function mode is a thing called the reordered row format. And reordered row format will automatically cut in for all types of table space when the page set is reallocated automatically in new function mode. Typically this is going to be a reorg, it could also be the load replace utility. What reordered row format tries to do is do two things. First of all, it tries to automatically implement on your behalf a long-standing tuning recommendation to have the fixed length columns on the left-hand side of the row and the varying length columns on the right-hand side of the row. And the second thing it tries to do is allow direct access to each and every varying length column. Now, like I say, it's on by default, applies to all table space types. It's application transparent, even for select asterisk. If you do a select asterisk, columns will always be returned in the order they were specified on the create table statement. But what will change is the format of the row as it's stored in the page set and also the image on the log. Now, first warning sign here is that if you're an installation that uses DSM1 copy, be careful because during the transition period, you may have reordered row format being used in one system and not in another. And therefore, you may have difficulty laying down a DSM-1 copy of an image copy because of that difference in the two environments. Also note that the reorg and load replace utilities will override the key dictionary keyword when migrating the page set for the first time. Now, in most cases, it will not be an issue, but bear in mind here that in some cases, this may lead to an increase in the logging volume. So the upside of reordered row format is reduced CPU resource consumption, particularly when you're processing many rows and there are many varying length columns inside that row. But as I say, the downside is that in some cases it may lead to an increase in logging volume. So if this increase in logging volume is unbearable, or you have various vendor tools that do not support the reordered row format, there is a hidden ZPARM called SPRM-RRF that you can switch on, which will actually disable the reordered row format. Now let's turn to slide 41. The universal table space is introduced for the first time in version 9. And a couple of important points. First of all, the default value for lock size on the universal table space is rho. And I want to make sure this is carefully interpreted because this is not a U-turn in terms of our previous recommendation. Our recommendation in DB2 has always been to use lock size page as a global design default. And so by making the default value for universal table space lock size rho, this is not a general recommendation or a U-turn to say use lock size rho everywhere. The recommendation is still the same, to use lock size page as a design default and only to use lock size rho in specific circumstances. The second point is that universal table spaces right now do not support member cluster. And many of you data sharing customers use member cluster for simple and classic partition table spaces to reduce page plock and page latch contention on space maps and even on the data page with lock size rho. So right now the universal table space does not support member cluster. Now in the release after version 9, we plan to introduce member cluster support for UTS, and we also plan to give you a better migration path. Because right now in version 9, the only migration path is to unload the data, drop and then recreate the table space as a UTS, and then load the data back in. So what we'd like to do in the release after version 9 is provide you with a new piece of function called deferred alter, whereby you can alter the table space to be UTS, and the next time the table space is reorganized, it will be converted from being partitioned or segmented or simple linear over to being a UTS. Another common question that gets asked is, should I use the new append option of create table in version 9, or should I continue to use the combination of member cluster with free page 0 and percent free 0? Both of these have their usage, okay? Now let me first of all talk about the version 9 append option. This option is very useful, and it's aimed at those types of tables, which are journal tables or audit or history tables, where all you simply want to do is have a very cheap insert at the end of the table. You don't care about space necessarily. You certainly do not care about clustering. And all DB2 is going to do is append at the end of the table. So a very efficient append operation. Now, when you've got the append option, if it's a history or a journal table and you decide to copy all the data out and then delete all the rows, then no problem. However, if your application wants to just delete a subset of the rows, then the problem with the append option is that the space created by deleting some of the rows will not ever be filled in. The only way to reclaim that lost space is to run a reorg. On the other hand, with member cluster free page 0, percent free 0, provided the inserts and deletes are spread around the members of the data sharing group, this option will enable DB2 to switch between insert and append mode. In other words, it will append at the end, but before extending, it will actually go and see if there is free space and then reuse that freed space and therefore avoid the need for a reorg. A thing to draw out and to remind you about here is, as I said, member cluster is widely used in data sharing for tables which are data entry style tables like journals, audit, history tables. And in order to get member cluster, it is only available right now on partitioned table spaces. Again, in the release after version 9, we will extend member cluster support to UTS. Now let's turn to slide 42. Another option which people are very interested in version 9 is this thing called the asymmetric leaf page split. Prior to version 9, when a leaf page splits, DB2 used to do it on a 50-50 basis. So half the index centers are left in the old leaf page, and half it was empty, and in the new leaf page, we moved over half of the index entries from the old leaf page. However, when people had particularly sequential keys or had multiple hotspots where the key was going up sequentially, this could be very inefficient, lead to lots of leaf page splits and latch class 6 contention in data sharing. Well, the initial algorithm for asymmetric leaf page splits worked reasonably well in non-data sharing, but in data sharing mode, it did not work particularly well. So bringing out a new APAR, PK62214, which will significantly enhance this algorithm. The original version only tracked the last insert position and a counter, but what the new APAR introduces is a new function with some advanced tracking and detection logic that should work much better. New approach remembers actually an insert range and tolerates entries being slightly out of sequence. And in most cases, this will work quite well. So an example on this chart here, if you've got 3, 2, 1, 6, 5, 4, etc., DB2 is able to determine here that these entries are moving in a general ascending direction. So a new algorithm will be a big improvement for this APAR, and it will protect a problem situation when you have a very large key size or if the entries come in a very bad order. Now let's turn to slide 43. There's some enhancements that will happen automatically in the area of index look-aside. Prior to version 9, there was limited use of index look-aside on secondary indexes during insert, delete, and update processing. In version 9, DB2 has extended index look-aside to non-clustering indexes where the cluster ratio is equal to or greater than 80%. Now, I've got a few points now to make about backup and restore system utilities and also object-level recover from system-level backups. So the first thing I'd like to say is you cannot perform an object-level recover from a system-level backup if the data set has moved away to a different volume since the system-level backup was taken. So here are three examples of how this could occur. First of all, as a result of doing a reorg, an object page set may move from one volume to another. Now, obviously, it's good practice, therefore, that when you do the reorg is taken performing an inline copy. However, if subsequently you want to do a point-in-time recovery to a point before the reorg, you cannot use an object-level recover from the system-level backup to do the job. Another example is where a storage administrator moves data sets around volumes to defrag those volumes, or the storage administrator is migrating the page set to a new DASD volume. So one way of dealing with this sort of issue is to augment the use of object-level recover from system-level backups by using the Recovery Expert tool or a vendor tool that provides equivalent function. So, for example, the Recovery Expert tool can deal with the situation where you want to perform a point-in-time recovery to a point before the reorg with the inline copy. Now let's turn to slide 44. When it comes to backup system, restore system, and object-level recovery from system-level backups, there are some careful considerations that need to be applied when, on one hand, you're using these utilities for local site recovery, and you're also using PPRC or XRC for disaster recovery. So if the production volumes that are being used are PPRC, XRC primary, the recovery utility, the object level recover from system-level backups, will not use flash copy to restore the object from the copy pool backup. Rather, it will use the normal DFDSS restore to do that, which will be a lot slower. Now, with ZOS APAR OA23849 with ZOS 1.8, DFSMS provides some new options which allow flash copy to work to a PPRC primary. So once this has been enabled by the FR backup repair command, then backup system, restore system, and the recovery utilities can then use flash copy to backup and restore data to and from DASD volumes that are PPRC primary. However, be careful here. The PPRC duplex pending condition will be set until the actual background copy has been completed. GDPS hyperswap will not tolerate the PPRC volumes being in a duplex pending state. So for some customers, the introduction of APAR OA23849 and use of the command FR backup prepare can have some issues here with a GDPS PPRC hyperswap environment. For those DB2 customers that use XRC for disaster recovery, the restore system utility cannot use flash copy to restore the DB2 system from a copy pool backup. And the restore system, however, can use the system-level backup, provided it is on tape. So those XRC customers that wish to use flash copy to restore their entire DB2 system to a previous point in time, they will need to disable XRC before running the restore system utility. Now let's turn to slide 45. Optimistic locking is a new function in version 9, but this is not just a special function for WebSphere. This is generally applicable to all customers. Optimistic locking is not something brand new. This approach or design approach has been around a long time. What's different, of course, is that in version 9, DB2 itself will automatically populate the timestamp token column on both insert and update and make sure it is always updated. And then the application, when reading the data before doing the update, can read the timestamp token, and then when it does the non-cursor update or delete, it can then do a conditional check on the where clause to make sure that the value of the timestamp token has not changed. In version 9, the real-time statistics tables have been moved into the catalog. And as such, real-time statistics is now always enabled. The in-memory statistics are always externalized to the RTS tables, where in V8, the process had to be explicitly started. The sample program shipped with DB2, DSN-TEP2, and DSN-4, these programs should really not be used until version 9 new function mode. You should only pre-compile, bound, and execute these programs once you've got to new function mode. Slide 46. In version 9, you can actually say modify recovery age and specify a value. But this will set copy pending for table spaces which are defined with define no, and whereby the space field in sysibm.sys/tablespot is set to -1. So the way around or the circumvention is to actually start the database or the object with access force. And the fixing APAR for this is PK69427. Another area where a number of customers experience performance regression is in the area of declared globally temporary tables, DGTTs. Some customers have seen as much as a 10 times increase in both the CPU resource consumption and the elapsed time when performing mass delete, which is a typical operation. And the underlying cause of this is excessive logging. The fixing APAR PK67301 will resolve this performance problem. Let's turn to slide 47. Many people are interested in using the new clone table support and also using the new SQL truncate command as a way of doing a mass delete to the rows. Now, what I'd like to point out here is the efficient mass delete of the data rows only works when the table space is a classic segmented or universal table space. So if you've got a classic partition table space, an SQL truncate function will be very inefficient. Each of the rows will be deleted individually and logged individually. And also, if that table space has several indexes on there, there's no such thing as an efficient mass delete of the index entries. So it's well advised that if you're going to use the SQL truncate statement to either use a classic segmented or universal table space for the table space and to keep the number of indexes on that table space to an absolute minimum. A common question that comes up all the time, and there's some confusion in our publications, is about the new option reopt called auto. Reopt auto at this stage in version 9 only applies to dynamic SQL. And probably in the release after version 9, we will consider extending this to static SQL. Now let's turn to slide 48. Now the last topic in the presentation here, or I should say the penultimate topic here in this presentation, is going to be talking about native SQL procedures and also talking about the relative performance of the different host languages for stored procedures. So there are two very nice changes related to SQL procedures in version 9, which are really useful in terms of reducing CPU resource consumption. So previously, SQL procedures have existed since version 6, but they were what we called external SQL procedures. The SQL procedure coding was converted into a C program, which was compiled and bound, and then executed as a WLM-managed store procedure. So in version 9, we now support a thing called native SQL procedures, where we eliminate the dependency on the C precompiler, and we avoid the need for a WLM-managed stored procedure. So when we do this, we do two things. We avoid the overhead of invoking the stored procedure, and we also avoid the overhead of a round trip between the WLM and the DBM1 address spaces for each SQL call. So this is very significant. So what we've observed is that for short-running SQL procedures, we've seen up to a 40% reduction in internal throughput. And internal throughput, basically, is basically inversely proportional to the CPU cost. So if we get a 40% ITR improvement, then that's equivalent here to also to having a 40% reduction in CPU resource consumption. But for long-running SQL procedures, we see little or no improvement. So obviously, mileage will actually vary. The other significant thing is that when these native SQL procedures are invoked using DRDO over TCP/IP, these native SQL procedures and the SQL statements themselves are now eligible for zip offload. To repeat, so if these native SQL procedures are invoked by DRDO over TCP/IP, the actual native SQL procedures, the SQL statements, are now eligible for zip offload. Whereas with the external SQL procedures, it was only the call of the stored procedure and the result set processing that was eligible for zip. And the reason for that, of course, is that we have to schedule the stored procedure into a WLM-managed address space, and therefore we switched out of enclave SRB mode into TCP mode. So these negative SQL procedures have these two big benefits of reduced CPU resource consumption from avoiding the overheads of stored procedure invocation and the round trip between the WLM and the DBM1 address spaces, and also get the eligibility for zip offload, and they're very easy to code, develop, and manage. And converting from external to native SQL procedures is very easy. I mean, basically, a native SQL procedure, the SQL statements are simply buried inside the package, and that package runs inside the DBM1 address space. There's no program code at all. So it's very simple in terms of preparing them and also the runtime deployment. Now let's turn to slide 49. A question that is often asked is, what about the relative performance of using different languages in the stored procedure environment? So I have one example which I'd like to share with you on this chart and the follow-on two charts. I'm obviously talking about a very specific environment here, which is listed on the chart, specifically ZOS 1.9, DB29 for ZOS, a particular level of the universal driver. Probably the most important ingredient here is that we're using our IRWW OLTP workload. Clearly, experience mileage will vary by different types of workload, but the key variable here is that we've got this IRWW OLTP-like workload where the transactions are of simple medium complexity. Now let's turn to slide 50. In slide 50, we have this table here, which on the left-hand side talks about the different languages for the stored procedures. It talks about the base billable cost, where performance equals cost, without zips and zaps. And the right-hand column talks about the billable cost after the zip and or the zap acceleration offload. So our baseline here is row 1 for the COBOL stored procedure, where the relative cost is 1. And basically, when we use zips and zaps, or particularly the zip in this case, we do actually get a little bit of offload for the call processing and also the result set processing. With the C-stored procedure, the figures are slightly better, but only marginal. And the third row there talks about remote SQLJ, in other words, remote SQLJ calls. Now, what you can see here is that without zip-zap technology, then there's quite a lot of overhead of remote SQLJ calls compared to the COBOL stored procedure. But once we actually get the benefit of zip and zap to reduce the billable cost, see a very healthy reduction in the cost from 1.78 down to 1.06. Next two rows compare a SQLJ stored procedure versus a JDBC stored procedure. And what you see here is obviously the value of the zip and zap, but also you can see the inherent value here in using SQLJ for SQL statements inside the Java stored procedure. And the last two rows here compare the base billable cost and the billable cost for both an external SQL procedure and a native SQL procedure. And what you can see is that with native SQL procedures, the performance of native SQL procedures is very, very good compared to the external procedure, and is actually almost better than COBOL based on this result. Now let's turn to slide 51. This chart just expresses the results in a slightly different way. So on the y-axis here is the throughput, and on the x-axis here is the various options. The ETR, or external throughput rate, is what was actually measured. And what we then did was we compared those, one option versus another, using ITR, which stands for internal throughput rate, which is just based on taking the ETR and normalizing it at 100% CPU busy to make a relative comparison. And this just reflects the results that were discussed on the previous slide. So the last topic I'd like to advertise here is just a checklist for you. If you're planning to be an early exploiter of XML, then basically there are some critical things to put in place here for basic XML parsing, if you want to use XML schemas, and also advertising particular ZPALMs for controlling the virtual storage. So this is just a checklist to help you plan for these particular functions. So this completes the end of the formal presentation as part of this webcast here. I hope this has been useful in terms of providing additional planning information, giving you a greater insight, and using the information in this presentation as a checklist going forward. What I'd now like to do is hand the presentation webcast back to the operator and open it up for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will have a live question and answer session with your presenter. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key, followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. Please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone a chance to respond. That was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference. If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. And once again, we'll pause for a moment. Do you have plans to move to DB29 for ZOS? If yes, in 2008, press star 1. If in 2009, press star 2. If you have no plans at this point, press star 3. And again, we'll pause. We hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. And again, we'll pause. And that does conclude our survey today. Thank you all for your participation. Now let's move to your questions. To ask your question, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. And we'll take our first question from John Kidd with IBM.
John, hi. A question about the merger of the DB2 work file with the temporary database that you were covering back on slide 30, I think it was. Is that capability, is that a post-GA enhancement in the maintenance stream, or has that always been there in version 9?
Yes, hello, John. Hopefully you can hear me okay.
Yeah.
Then basically, that was in the base release.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
I'll take our next question from Teresa Breen with Siemens.
Yes, on page 39, there's a new automatic implicit check page, and I was wondering if there is a problem, how are you made known of that?
Yeah, hi, Teresa. So basically what used to happen before was that we used to set the copy-pen condition.
Right.
And, of course, the good news was it was good that we found the problem, right? The bad news
right.
was we blocked all the updates there and then. So basically what we do in version 9 is that we don't set the copy-pen condition. We put out, obviously, messages in the output of the copy indicating what the errors are. And we insert a new type of row into the syscopy table. And the only reason we put that row into the syscopy table is simply to make sure that the next image copy is a full image copy.
Oh, okay.
And the reason is, you know, why do that? I mean, the only reason we set the copy pen condition in the first place was that you may have found a problem as a result of running an incremental. And remember, copy is actually an update utility, really, because it's going through and updating pages. So it's just a way of forcing us, in this situation, to force a full copy. So it's just going to insert a new row into the syscopy table so that the very next copy you run would be a full copy. Doesn't block any updaters. And obviously the pages that are in error will be reported in the output of the copy utility.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Bill Rep with Protective Life.
Yes, John. Good day.
Yeah,
I enjoyed your presentation very much today. On page 39 also, page size greater than 4K is a requirement for index compression. What is the best way to get an index into a 8K page size to take advantage of index compression?
Well, unfortunately, right now, it means a drop and a recreate of the index in order to do that.
Okay.
But, you know, as I said, you know, before we never had any choice about index pages sizes. They were always 4K. And this actual release introduces, you know, index compression, and that depends on having a larger page size. What we're looking to do in the release after version 9 is provide you what I would call a deferred alter support, whereby you'll do the DDL change, and then the next time a reorg gets scheduled, like an online reorg, we will actually do the changes for you. And so the intent there is that changing the page size could be done that way. And also, it would give you a nice, easy way to migrate from the current classic segmented or partition table space to use UTS. Because today with UTS, Universal Table Space, you have to drop and recreate and then unload and reload the data either side of it. So that's the direction we're on right now. But in order to get a larger page size, it's a drop and a recreate.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And we'll take our next question from Jeff Cram with Wells Fargo.
Hi, John. I had a question about the copy enhancements on slide 39. Are those all in conversion mode? And secondly, in terms of the rest of the utilities, are they also, besides the one you listed above with the object level recover, are the rest of the utilities available in conversion mode?
Well, the first part of the question is easy, which is that it is available in conversion mode. However, in terms of the rest of the utility function, it's basically not a nice, crisp, clear statement as I would like it to be. A lot of stuff is available. I guess the rule of thumb I would give you is that basically if a piece of function would stop you falling back, like, for example, switching to reordered row format, then that's not available until new function mode. But anything that basically would not prevent you falling back is available in conversion mode. In the release after version 9, we plan to be a lot more strict about this because it creates confusion for customers like yourself and also me as to whether individual pieces of function are available or not. So I think what I did was, I think it's at the top of this chart here, the one thing that's not obvious to anybody is that this object level recover is available because intuitively you would have thought that was a new function mode piece of function. Whereas the other thing, like recovering to a point in time with consistency, that is in new function mode. So that was one example that I've already discovered that needed to be called out.
Great. Thank you.
And next we'll hear from Richard Prano with State Street Corporation.
Hi, John. This question refers to slide 21. One of our problems with migrations was always the issue with whether we do a bind or not. One of the options you mentioned for the strategy was to bind into a test collection. We thought of that, but we couldn't come up with any viable way of comparing or automating the comparison of the new collection with the old collection. I was wondering if you know of any way, and a corollary question to that is if we did take that strategy of binding to a test collection, I'm assuming we wouldn't want to turn on the ZParm for plan management. Otherwise, we would risk dropping the collection and the prior or original package as well.
All right. Well, let me just try and deal with the spirit of this question. I mean, I spent a long time in today's presentation about this plan stability for static SQL because I think it's really important. You know, we create a lot of problems for our customers in version 8, and sometimes the customers create the problems for themselves by either having stale or incomplete statistics. So actually, I want to encourage people to rebind. I mean, you want to rebind on a release migration or sometime within the life of a release to combat CPU regression. And I pointed out during this session that although we originally said there was no value for, in terms of reducing CPU resource consumption by doing a rebind early, I pointed out that the SPROCs were invalidated. So the only reason in the context of this presentation that I started talking about dummy collections again was purely if people say, okay, I can't afford the space. And for most customers in production, that's a non-issue, that SPT01 is not too big. But I don't mean to insult anybody, but a number of customers have very large SPT01s in development, which have largely become polluted over time because people have built packages in collections, and basically nobody knows whether they're actually being used or not, and therefore people are frightened to go in and cull it. So the only reason I introduced the idea of dummy collections again, because that was a version 8 thought, was simply a way of people say, okay, I can't afford to have plan stability as a global default. Let's just have a test collection where we'll bind everything in there and then have the ability to compare the access bars. And if the access path doesn't change, then we can do a rebind without using the plan management keyword on the package, yeah? And if there is a change, this is the particular area where we'll use the plan management keyword on the package. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So I guess the bottom line then is as long as you have room in SPT01, the better option is to go with the plan stability.
Yeah, it is.
And
mm-hmm. Exactly. That's how I prefer you to go. But as I said, some customers are constrained on SPT01. I mean, the maximum limit is 64 gig. And I guess probably 95% plus of customers, that's definitely not a problem in production. I rarely find anybody who's got that problem near production. But, of course, in development, there are several customers in that area. So one thing we've done for one particular customer installation at the moment is we've provided them with a user mod which turns on ESA compression for SPT01. Now, if that becomes successful, we will make that available via a ZPALM option. So we have this customer who really wants to use the plan stability, but their concern is about SPT01 growth and development. So if this ESA compression user mod works okay, then we'll make that a standard feature that will be enabled via ZPALM, but it's too early on that at the moment.
Thank you, John.
Yeah.
We'll take our next question from Addy Moore with IBM.
Hi, John. It's just a quick question. With regards to the client table syntax, is there any plans to introduce this at the partition level?
Not at the moment, Adi. It is a requirement on our backlog, but right now there's no firm plans to do that.
Okay, so nothing in D29 plus one either yet?
Yeah, no.
No, okay. And the other one, quick one then, John, was in version 8, we had an APAR that was introduced, which is PK03946. And that was to give us some support for those SQL queries that were using a union and they weren't labeling them correctly. I've tested that with D29 and the hidden ZPALM is still there. My question really is so that we can try and advise our development community is it going to remain throughout the DB29 lifecycle, that hidden ZPALM, and is there any plans to remove it in DB29 plus one?
Good question, Adi. Now, I really don't know the answer right now. I'm actually taking a wider berth on your question, okay,
yeah,
in answering this. I mean, there are a lot of these hidden ZPALMs in the optimizer area, and the intent is really, it's meant to be a cautious approach that we're taking, but the intent is, basically, if things work well, then that should be the default in the next release. And I've already come across one particular one of these ZPALMs where actually it tries to, what the ZPalm does, I can't remember the exact name of it right now, but what it tries to do is basically accentuate the value of index-only access. And that was a hidden ZPalm in version 8, and it should have been on by default in version 9, and it wasn't. And we're going to correct that, okay? So what I'd like you to do is, if you can drop me an email, you've got my email ID, can you drop me an email after that, and I will chase that for you?
Yeah, sure, John, no problem.
But that's what the intent is, that these things are meant to be put on. You can call them Bravehearts, which is whatever you want to, that basically, without changing the default behavior in a release in the field, the idea is that these features will be basically available under the advice of IBM service. And if everything is okay, they should be rolled into the previous release. What I don't like, AD, is that if this is just left like this, then basically it's all by word of mouth or when you get particular advice through the service team. So it'd be nice to get a nice, crisp answer about it.
Yeah, that's great, John. I'll drop you a line on that.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
And now we'll hear from Marianne Uvari with Siemens.
Hey, John, I had a question regarding the DB2 Connect prerequisite on page 4. It said there version 9.5, fixed pack 1, but I was pretty sure when you were stating it, you said version 9.1, yep. Fixed pack 1, and I just wanted to clarify what was the fixed pack for 9.1, and I gather for 9.5 it's fixed pack 1.
Yeah, so you're absolutely spot on in what you said here. I mean, on the slides that I submitted for the webcast here, I did actually say 9.5, and that, in fact, is a typo. It's actually correct in what I said during this webcast. It should be if you're going to use 9.1 of DB2 Connect, then you must have fixed pack 1. It's not good enough to have the GA version of 9.1 of DB2 Connect. On the other hand, if you have the GA version of 9.5 without any fixed pack on, that is good enough.
Thank you.
But I'd like to just take a wider berth on that question as well. I can almost predict that I would get a question on DB2 Connect levels during this web in the Q&A here. And your question was a very nice one, and it's good that you spotted that, and very important. But often what I'm getting about questions is, will a certain fixed pack of whatever, you know, it'd be version 8 or version 9? And these are the basic levels that are in the program directory. 9.5 isn't in the program directory, but as I said here, the GA version of 9.5 will also work. But the problem I'm having here, a general problem, is that DB2 Connect infrastructure in many customers is not being maintained. And therefore, we're getting these questions where we're getting levels that are further back than these levels. Now, if we take one example, if you look at version 8.1 fixed pack 13 of DB2 Connect, that's not some golden level. That's the minimum level. And in fact, some people have had some problems on fixed pack 13 and have had to move forward to 14 and 15. So for you and other people on this webcast here, my general advice to people now is to maintain your DB2 Connect infrastructure, the server part of your DB2 Connect infrastructure, in the same way that you would maintain DB2. And therefore, what you should do is go out and look on the IBM website for CST, the consolidated server testing. I mean, that's what DB2 uses, for example, to build the RSU levels. And basically what you should do is go in, check in there, and find out what levels of DB2 Connect are being used for the CST testing. And I think you should adopt those as being the minimum level.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And our next question comes from Howard Hirsch with IBM.
Hi, John. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, John, one of the things you mentioned was truncating tables with partition truncates in that you don't initialize the indexes after a truncate.
Yes.
How do you suggest you clear out the indexes?
Well, one thing you could do, I mean, the point I'm trying to say here is that, you know, at first hand you think, oh, truncate's fantastic. What it is, when the underlying table space is segmented or UTS, because they always have this special SQL mass delete to purge the data. All they simply did was change the space map, log it, and get out of the way. Whereas with simple and partition, we logged them. We deleted the rows individually and logged them. Well, if you have indexes on a table, there's no special mass delete for the index either. So therefore, these are logged individually. So one message is keep the number of indexes to the minimum. Or the other thing to do is to actually drop these indexes before doing the truncate, and then put them back again afterwards. It would be better to drop them, then create them, defer, and then rebuild the indexes afterwards.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And our next question comes from Gene Trzupek with HSBC.
John, thank you very much for the presentation. Question concerning some clarification regarding ZIP stored procedures and the SQL stored procedure builder.
Yes.
My understanding is that under version 8, only stored procedures built using the SQL stored procedure builder are ZIP eligible. And under version 9, this SQL stored procedure builder is no longer a requirement. Is that correct? Or?
Yeah, just to make sure there, you're really talking here about SQL procedures, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah, so basically the stored procedure builder before with SQL procedures was basically a way of building the C program. And it was therefore an external, it was basically an external stored procedure that got scheduled into a WLM managed address space. So basically what happened was you have the request coming in over DRDA, TCP, IP, so therefore it's running on an enclave SRB. But the moment the stored procedure got scheduled into the WLM managed address space, it was in TCP mode. So will it be so regardless of whether it's an external, external SQL procedure, or it was a COBOL or a PL1 stored procedure, then basically the only ZIP offload you got was for the call statement basically to invoke the procedure and for processing the result sets back. The difference in version 9 with the native SQL procedure is you can take the SQL procedure statements and just create that procedure inside DB2, and we'll create a package, and the statements are buried in the package. And the difference is that when the SQL procedure is invoked, we don't switch from enclave SRB mode into TCP mode, and that means all the SQL inside that native SQL procedure is now ready for ZIP offload. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
So basically, I mean, most people know it's a bit of an open secret that basically what we try to do, when we've got SQL statements like SQL statements and now these native SQL statements, procedures, we try to offload, 55% of the workload onto the ZIP. So I think the native SQL procedures in version 9 looks really attractive for those sort of applications with, simple to medium type of complexity.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And our final question comes from Svetlana Kakapur with GEICO.
Hi, John.
Yeah, hi there.
I have a question about plane stability and using it on the rebind package level, not set in ZParms. If we use it once to rebind the package, is it recorded that way for the package so the next rebind will work the same way, or it has to be specified every time the package is rebound?
So basically the default for, the plan management is to have it off. So there's really three values for it. You can say basic or extended, or the other word is off. So basically, once it's not set as a ZPOM, if it's not set to basic or extended in a ZPOM, then it's controlled basically by the plan management keyword on the bind. And it's not remembered. So if you don't specify it on a subsequent rebind, then it won't make any changes to the versions.
So the old versions will stay, and it will be rebound without keeping track of the previous version.
That's right. Yeah, it's just okay. It's going to overlay the current version, and the previous one will be left lying around.
Okay, that was the question. Thank you.
And Mr. Campbell, we have no further questions at this time. I'll turn things back to you for closing comments.
I'd like to thank everybody for participating in today's session. I know it was a long session, and I was going at quite some pace to cover all the material. So I'd like to thank you for your patience and your questions, and hopefully you'll be able to download this MP3 file, following the presentation or webcast, and then you'll be able to go through it again or share it with other people in installations. Thank you very much.
And once again, that does conclude today's presentation. We appreciate your participation and wish you all a great day.